Hello, I'm Andy Burnham. Welcome to Sparks. This week, gangsters ring up telephone profits, Radio 2 reforms, a bid for the UK AM national radio franchise, a profile of Stephen Hawking, caged mind that roams the cosmos. It's all over for tape hiss, apparently. With DCC and mini disc round the corner, is it too late for Dolby S? HDTV news including Russian plans and a new design of video modulator. Of course, your letters, as every week, it's Sparks, our weekly programme of science, technology and media news on Radio Fax 3910 6205 and 12255.
Gangsters ring up telephone profits. Ed Vogliami in Naples, reporting in The Guardian. Even the giddy excesses of Italy's telephone charges could not explain the 8 million lira bill, £3,700, received by Councillor Ermanno Russo of Naples for a car telephone he says he barely uses. And indeed, this time, Italy's appalling telephone company was not to blame. Mr. Russo had become the latest victim of the 900 MHz gang, who had imported hundreds of English mobile telephones and hooked them up to numbers of unsuspecting subscribers, who were then sent the bills run up by the Camorra gangsters. The gangsters were helped by a tame telephone exchange director in Pisa and an electronics expert, Francesco Galletta of La Spezia in Tuscany. The SIP telephone company and mobile telephone owners lost more than £14 million in less than a year, according to Captain Giuseppe Palumbo, head of the Naples flying squad, who arrested Mr. Galletta, computer advisor to the gang, and 27 others. The deal was simple. The Camorra was under pressure from tenacious police telephone tapping and needed to make its assassination and drug dealing arrangements on carefully selected safe telephone lines, quite apart from saving money on calls. And Mr. Galletta knew how to hook a cleaned, doctored and decoded mobile telephone onto either an existing number or to a dormant number. Mr. Galletta's firm imported telephones from the Midland Electronics Company of England. These models were cheap compared to prices on the inflated Italian market and had the advantage of not being standardised or approved for use in Italy. If they had been, the importers would have been expected to pay a tax of some £250 per telephone. But instead, Mr. Galletta and two colleagues, Ferruccio Landi and Giuseppe Rossi, cleaned the telephones by removing their serial numbers from the microchip innards of the machines and inserting a computer code authorised by the SIP telephone company, which would log them into the domestic telecommunications network. There were now two options, and therefore two services on offer. Either the telephones could be assigned to numbers already in use by reproducing their computer codes in the new telephone's memories, or they could be hooked up to a number which had not yet been assigned to anyone, so the bills could only have been sent to phantom addresses. The Camorra, Mr. Galletta's principal and most enthusiastic customer, found the former Wii's more reliable for the Mafia's dual purposes of free and unmonitored telephone conversations, many of them to contacts overseas and notably in South America. And so the Di Maro company from San Giovanni Tiduccio, nestling under Mount Vesuvius, and two Neapolitan electronics dealers, Luigi Maestro Giacomo and Pasquale Calise, found suitable numbers for Mr. Galletta to work on and an eager sales market among their contacts in the criminal underworld. The victims, subscribers to Italy's current craze for mobile telephones, included a laboratory director, a renowned Tuscan businessman, academics from Naples and Tuscany, and even an electronics engineer. All were considered to be rich or busy enough to pay little heed to their telephone bills, but ordinary enough not to attract attention, and completely without criminal associations. Among them was Mr. Russo, whose complaint 3 months ago initiated the investigation which uncovered the thriving racket in selling contraband mobile phones, properly standardised for legal registration, at less than half their Italian market price. Ed Vulliami there in Naples.
Here's the latest report from Alan Dean. Good to hear Radio North Sea International featured. One of the best of the offshore stations. I look forward to continuing to tune your way throughout the year and supplying the monthly reports. He says he used to contribute to North Sea Goes DX regularly as well. So here goes with this month's Merseyside news. Only three stations on air recently. KISS FM continuing daily with a tape programme on 100.5. Toxteth Community Radio also continue daily with varied programming, including Arabic, Asian and Chinese languages. Programmes are live on 104, apparently. Concept Radio is on the air at times. They were reported during Christmas and the New Year. Also, two Asian stations continuing from Blackburn on 100 and 101. So to shortwaves. Radio Dublin now regular daily on 6910, and WNKR will be dropping 6275 and using 7400 only. Pirate Freaks broadcasting service heard recently on 6285 and 1140 using a new address. Radio Ridiculous was noted on Christmas Day on 6220 from the Netherlands. Free Sound Radio was heard on 6218 on the 29th of December using Radio Waves French address. Radio Geronimo from the UK also heard was on 6240 using the well-known Wuppertal address. Radio Zenith heard on 6305 using a new address. And in Australia, the time signal station VNG are using 16,000 kilohertz from 22 till 10 daily, audible at times here in the UK. In Denmark, Radio Denmark has an English news bulletin from Monday to Saturday at 7 o'clock in the morning on long wave 243 kilohertz. Voice of Greece have English news for Europe daily from 7:20 in the evening until 7:30. That can be heard on 9395 and 7450. RAI from Italy have English to Europe daily at 7:35 until 7:55 on 7275, 9710 and 11800. In Syria, Radio Damascus have English daily from 8:05 and 9:05 in the evening on 15095 and 12085. The future of Radio Moscow is unclear at the moment, and some staff apparently are worried about their jobs. New on from Russia is Adventist World Radio. Transmissions intended mainly for Asia, and programming will come from the AWR Media Centre in Tula near Moscow. They're on 100 kilowatts and will be increasing to 250 kilowatts later in the year. They'll be known as AWR Russia. Now, if you have a local report from your part of the world, I'd be delighted to hear it. That's FM stations in your part of the world and also the shortwave stations you can hear. The address to write to is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6, 7BG. I guarantee to give you a hello on the air, and if you send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons or $1, you'll receive our station card. Also, technical information about the transmitter site and an artist's impression. The address again, Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6, 7BG.
Reality,
reality,
I wanna say love.
Robert Foote, one of our recent winners of the 1992 Radio Listener's Guide, writes from Rauner in Hampshire. This is my third communication with you in as many months, and I've already told you how much I appreciate your programmes, and indeed you being on the air. So I'll just say again that I continue to listen to you almost every day, and particularly enjoy the archive programmes, and of course Sparks, as I've always been fascinated with all aspects of broadcasting. Many thanks for your review of the Radio Listener's Guide. This was the first time I'd heard of this publication, and it sounds very interesting indeed. Well, I hope you've received it by now. He reports excellent reception on 6205 and beautiful audio quality on 3910. There is very little interference on this frequency. It was obviously very carefully chosen. 12255 is, of course, sporadic at my location, usually not audible, but sometimes reaching about 5.5 for a few minutes at a time. My receiver is a Matsui MR4099, Curry's own brand name for the Sangyan ATS-803A, an excellent receiver I've found with a 30-metre long wire, although I can also receive you on 6205 on a Sharp radio cassette recorder with just the telescopic aerial. In my next letter, I must try and convey to any of your listeners who are thinking of making or buying a medium-wave loop antenna just how incredibly effective they are. Well, I'd agree with that comment, and thanks for the letter, Robert Foote. Designing a TV modulator is a bit like reinventing the wheel when there are cheap mass-produced modules already available, but these have limitations, and there's merit in starting from scratch. Adrian McLeod reports in New Electronics. The vision signal received by a TV aerial is amplitude modulated and the sound frequency modulated. The output from a video recorder or satellite receiver must be modulated in a similar fashion if it is to connect directly to the TV's aerial socket. To do this, such products are generally fitted with a standard module. These are manufactured in their millions and provide a simple and cheap way to modulate video signals. However, Andy Coe, Senior Development Engineer at Pace Microtechnology in Shipley, has designed a modulator from scratch for the firm's latest satellite receiver. This is not as contrary as it seems. There are many sound reasons for eschewing the standard module. One is the limited bandwidth of the standard modules. They cover only channels 30 to 40, which, with the proliferation of network channels, specifically channel 5, video recorders, cameras, and satellite stations, it's sometimes not enough. It can be difficult to find space free from interference, Coe said. His design covers the full available bandwidth, channels 21 to 69, giving users a much better chance of finding a free channel. Changing the setting of the standard UHF modulators is cumbersome. They come preset, usually to channel 36. If this is not suitable, the user must align them with a screwdriver. Coe's design has a digital input, allowing it to be automatically set by the satellite receiver's processor. Commercially available modules tend to use free-running oscillators. Coe has been able to make the oscillator in his design more stable by using a quartz clock and a phase-locked loop. While the final circuit is likely to work out slightly more expensive than standard modules, the advantages of software control and increased channel range make the design more than worthwhile. A lot more technical details in that article, but the basis is this company are making their own fancy modulator, which seems odd when they're bearing the cost of these channel 5 problems, when it's normal understanding that the person who goes for the contract is going to have to pay for all the retuning. But it's very nice of them to provide easy retuning on their latest satellite receiver. You're listening to Sparks from Radio Facts.
In the Daily Telegraph, Wrecker or Redeemer? Gillian Reynolds talks to the head of Radio 2 about her much-criticised reforms. I am, at the moment, the Wicked Queen. Frances Lyne, controller of BBC Radio 2, appears resigned to her fate. Over the past few months, since news of her changes to the network leaked out, she has had sackfuls of highly personal hate mail, letters calling her pillock-brained git, pictures with her eyes poked out. The changes, have started. Some programs are in different places. There are new voices on the air. The music sounds different. Why? The median age of the audience is 61. Unless I take some sort of avoiding action, it will go up. I must pull it down, she says. Why is the age of the audience important? Radios 1 and 2 are meant to be complementary. Radio 1 is meant to serve people from the cradle to about age 40. Radio 2 from 40 onwards. If the median age of Radio 1 listeners is 29 and that of Radio 2 is 61, there's clearly a hole in the middle. What's happened to the 40s to 50s? I'm looking to bring our listening age down by about 10 years. I'm not ditching the over 55s. I'm trying to hold on to the listeners we have, but to widen our constituency, she says. It is an urgent task. Since Radio 2 transferred solely to FM 16 months ago, the listening figures have fallen with a bump. What was a regular weekly audience of 11 million is now 9.2 million. A network occupying a valuable FM frequency but talking to fewer and fewer people is very vulnerable. Radio 2 has found itself on the brink of extinction before, several times. Always some friendly hand has pulled it back. This time could be decisive. If line fails, the network will vanish, maybe even by the end of the year. What she must show to keep it is that Radio 2 is a significant national service which only the BBC can provide. Given that there will be two national commercial networks on air by the autumn, the challenge is real. The plan is to do it partly through new presenters, partly through the music. As we talked, she called it changing the mix a bit, then decided to drive home a somewhat contentious point. There is, she declared firmly, no ban on pre-1950s music. All there is going to be is a more consistent sound to the network in the daytime. Hadn't the news of all this been badly handled then? We were bounced into premature announcements by leaks. The minute you talk to presenters about change, they know there's something going on. It's a great shame. We'd have liked to announce what was going to happen nearer the date, but you can't keep it under wraps. If you're letting people go, you have to let them find other work. The contracts here are only for a year, not for life. But hadn't listeners written in protesting mightily, for instance, at the removal of Chris Stewart to make way for the new show with Derek Jameson and his wife? In Radio 4, she said, with some feeling, because she was the controller's assistant there before she moved to Radio 2, when you move programmes, you move programmes. Here, on Radio 2, you're dealing with people, and it looks like you're attacking people. There's a fierce protectiveness, sometimes bordering on obsession, towards the presenters. The only thing I can go on is the research. So what does the research show? For 93% of people, the prime attraction on Radio 2 is the music. Over the years, we've let the speech ratio creep up. The message is to tell them to shut up and play the music. So why pick a man whose speciality is speech, Brian Hayes, for the new breakfast show? She replies, it's a different breakfast show. A briefing for the day. No guests. Pacey, music-led. He feels he can do it. Will enjoy it. He did start life as a music presenter, you know. Does she know where the missing Radio 2 listeners have gone? Yes, I do. In London, they've gone to Capital Gold, to Melody and LBC. But this change is not a reaction to competition. It's about genuine network choice. I'm moving Richard Baker from Sunday mornings because what he does then is too much like Radio 3. On the other hand, we're not just a gold station. If we used a computer to plot the music, you wouldn't get that lovely breadth that you do on Radio 2. I do like the odd surprise, and you don't get that with a computer. When will she know if it's worked? You've got to let it run for 6 months to let the audience settle. I expect a little bump while we all settle down, but we'll be monitoring it from the start and with great interest. I just want the piece of audience I'm supposed to be looking after. So says Francis Lyne, controller of BBC Radio 2, talking to Gillian Reynolds in the Daily Telegraph.
Splashing of the kingfisher, flashing to the water, and a river of green is sliding unseen beneath the trees, laughing as it passes through the endless summer, making for the sea. In the lazy water meadow I lay me down, all around me golden sunflakes settle on the ground, basking in the sunshine of a bygone afternoon, bringing sounds of yesterday into this city room. Hear the lark and hearken to the barking of the dog fox gone to ground. See the splashing of the kingfisher flashing to the water, and a river of green is sliding unseen beneath the trees, laughing as it passes through the endless summer, making for the sea. Hear the lark and hearken to the barking of the dog fox gone to ground. See the splashing of the kingfisher flashing to the water. A river of green is sliding unseen beneath the trees, laughing as it passes through the endless summer, making for the sea.
In electronics world news, former Soviet agency undertakes an ambitious project. HDTV plans underway in Russia by Yunko Yoshida. Even as it remains in the throes of political turmoil, the former Soviet Union is emerging as a player in the high-definition TV sweepstakes. At a recent conference, scientists from the All-Union Research Institute for TV and Radio Broadcasting unveiled plans to build an experimental HDTV network in time for this summer's Olympic Games in Barcelona. The Russians have not yet decided which HDTV standard they will adopt, but with an eye on the huge potential market for HDTV in the republics, television marketers around the world had been closely watching the Kremlin's decisions regarding video technology. Oleg G. Nozov, a scientist in Moscow, told the attendees at the conference, "According to the latest news, we neither know who is the leader of our country, nor are we sure any longer of the name of the country we're from. Nevertheless, Nozov said, Soviet authorities had earlier decided to put an experimental fiber cable and radio relay HDTV network into operation in Moscow by the opening day of the Barcelona Games, and these plans remain in place. He estimated that an annual investment of 15 to 20 million rubles would be necessary over a period of 5 years to develop an HDTV infrastructure in the new Commonwealth. But we are committed to the project, and that's why we are seeking investors. Please help us, Nozov said. A number of HDTV companies worldwide are expected to offer support for the Barcelona project. The plan was greeted by some interesting reactions. At one point, Nozov asked R.L. van Oostenbroek, broadcast media manager at Philips International, if Philips would support the proposed HDTV network. His response was blunt. Wouldn't you need something more practical than HDTV in your country now? Like food? Oostenbroek asked. Nozov paused for a second and replied, No, no, you see, we are engineers. We don't care about food. We want HDTVs. Oostenbroek then assured Nozov that the Russians will get support from Philips and others for the Barcelona Olympic broadcasts. An experimental HDTV studio is being built at Vinitir, Nozov said. The facility will be equipped with a Tektronix sync and test HDTV generator, two Soviet-produced HDTV video recorders, an HDTV monitor, and an HDTV projector. The studio will also contain corresponding switching and routing equipment, which is now under development at the TV laboratories. Engineers at Niti are helping develop a large-screen HDTV projector, Nosov added. That's Russian news about high-definition television in Electronic World News. And while on the subject of Russia, cosmonauts are considering striking over low wages, less than £4 a month, and astronomical prices, cringe, said Moscow Television News. One of the most prestigious jobs on Earth has become one of its lowest paid, it reported. And now another story about high-definition television.
Wide-eyed and clueless, by Barry Fox in International Broadcasting. There is only one agreed norm for the future of television. Screens will have a 16:9 wide aspect ratio instead of the 4:3 box ratio, which has been standard since electronic television services began in the late 1930s. Everything else, line scanning structure, frame and field rate, signal waveform, colour and sound coding, will continue to differ from continent to continent. European manufacturers have sensibly coined a catchy generic term, Cinevision, to replace the awkward 16:9 tag. Already, Thomson is selling its Space System 16:9 television sets on the mainland of Europe and will launch in the UK next year, though Philips will probably get there first. Nokia ITT has a 16:9 set too. But there is already a confusing technology split, and even more confusing squabbles over the best way to transmit widescreen pictures into the home. Both Thomson and Nokia think it is important to enhance picture quality by artificially doubling the number of interlaced scanning lines from 625 to 1250. Philips believes it is more important to double the scanning rate, displaying an interlaced 625 lines at 100 Hz instead of 50 Hz, in order to eliminate the flicker, which at 50 Hz is very noticeable in wide areas of white, snow or sky. Next, Philips plans a 100 Hz television set with progressive scan, where each picture is written from a full 625 lines, instead of interlaced 312.5 lines. The public had its first real taste of the 16:9 format at this year's Berlin Funkausstellung, which has been transformed from a radio show into an electronics bonanza spread over 25 exhibition halls and a wide expanse of gardens. Demonstrations at the exhibition of the two currently available display techniques of 1250 line interlaced at 50 Hz and 625 line interlaced at 100 Hz show that there is very little to choose between them. Any noticeable differences were overshadowed by the fact that all the demonstrations of domestic non-high definition television 16:9 were marred by poor picture quality, although demonstrators admitted that there was a problem, they could not explain why. The D2 Mac and HD Mac signals from TVSat were being distributed by cable round the exhibition site using 12 MHz allocations in the hyperband, which is a band around 300 to 400 MHz, within that used by German and French cable networks. This has not been used before because of fears of interference with terrestrial services. Poor terminations on the Berlin exhibition site cable network introduced short group delay echoes. To make things worse, a mechanical digger cut through the cable the day before the show opened, and the cable was clumsily joined. Whereas the digital equalization circuits in a full-blown HD TV set can compensate for spurious short echo signals, other sets cannot. So, while high-definition television demonstrations were impressive, standard definition widescreen Mac displays of the same material were not. I suspect that many visitors left the show wondering what all the fuss about Mac quality was about. Ironically, these rather disappointing demonstrations of 16:9 D2 Mac coincided with the first public demonstration of PAL Plus, the widescreen version of conventional PAL, which Grundig, Nokia, Philips, Thomson, and European broadcasters have been developing in parallel with high-definition television. The PAL Plus prototype gave better pictures than D2Mac. Recognizing PAL Plus as a political hot potato, its designers stress that their system, which is still the size of a refrigerator, is intended only for terrestrial use and will not be ready for domestic use until the mid-90s, when HD-Mac is scheduled for service. They only admit when pushed that, of course, PAL Plus could be used equally well by satellites. At the same time, politicians and broadcasters were squabbling over the European Commission's plans to force satellite broadcasters into using D2Mac. During the show, Technology Commissioner Filippo Pandolfi floated his plan for the EC to spend a billion ECUs on subsidising double illumination, that is, simulcasting all PAL programme transmissions from satellites in D2Mac. The whole debate seems like a shameless waste of taxpayers' money, as the problem was created by the EC's failure to draft a solid Mac directive in the first place, following its failure to tighten the careless wording of that directive in 1988, when Rupert Murdoch announced his plans to broadcast in PAL from Astra. And the European Parliament may very well veto the scheme, even if Pandolfi gets the legally binding memorandum of understanding he wants from the satellite industry. The common sense solution is surely for the EC to forget about a directive which forces all satellite broadcasters to simulcast all PAL programmes in D2Mac, and to stop trying to force an end to PAL by some arbitrary date. The European Commission should also stop talking about D2Mac and stop telling manufacturers what circuitry they must build in their receivers. Instead, the EC should start talking about widescreen and leave it to the broadcasters and manufacturers to see for themselves that D2Mac is not only the best technology for the format, but it is also available now. The EC could then spend some of our money, but not the entire mooted billion ECUs, to fund simulcasts of movie and possibly sports channels in widescreen format, all from the same satellite as the PAL transmissions. Virtually all film material is already available in widescreen format, and there is little to gain from widescreening news, pop music and Sky One reruns. The manufacturers could then build D2Mac circuits into any widescreen set, simply labelling them as satellite Cinevision ready. Then the public would get a taste of widescreen TV without anyone getting confused about D2Mac, PAL, HDMac, PAL Plus, and 16:9. My only fear is that this pragmatic approach may prove too simple and sensible for Pandolfi and the Commission to adopt. That piece by Barry Fox, published in International Broadcasting.
The world is just a great big onion. And hate and fear are the vices that make you cry. Oh, baby. And the only way to get free of this great.
Love seeds until it dies. a great big onion.
You're listening to Sparks on Radio Fax. Every week it's our technical programme of media and scientific news. This week presented by Andy Burnham and Trevor Brook. Here's a letter from Ulrich Beckmann in Jorgsmarienhut in Germany. I've been listening to remote radio for 6 years. I'm 34 years old and I work in a photo shop here in Rhein for 50 kilometres far from Osnabrück in the northern part of Germany. He listens on 3910 and has a Sony ICF SW77 Longwire indoor antenna. Also, hello to Ramunas Starter in Ukmerg in Lithuania. He's listening on 6205 with an R250M2 and a 20-metre Longwire aerial. He says, thank you. Well, thanks back to Ramunas Starter in Lithuania.
It's all over for Tape Hiss from Q magazine. With DCC and Minidisc set for launch this year, it looks like curtains for the traditional cassette. But the trusty tape is making a valiant last stand in the shape of the ultimate hiss-reducing Dolby S system. John Baldy wonders if it's all too late. Unsuspecting visitors to the Heathrow Penta might have been forgiven for thinking that they'd stumbled accidentally into a most horrible nightmare, for this unloveliest of hotels was again the venue for the UK's annual hi-fi show and had thus been transformed for a weekend in something very much like one of the noisier, nastier circles of hell, with all manner of merchandising stalls filling the foyer, thinly walled bedroom fulls of gear of the year crashing out mega decibel cacophony, and battalions of soberly suited sales reps touting their wares to dubious dealers or coping stoically with the seemingly endless streams of plastic bag clutching punters queuing up to quiz them unmercifully on the minutiae of hi-fi. Meanwhile, in the shadowy corners of the hotel's dark and bewildering corridors, the below-the-breath mutterings were mainly of future formats, with appetites well whetted for the arrival of the two main contenders for digital recording domination of the 1990s, digital compact cassette and minidisc. And yet, in the Penta's Viscount suite, there was one unashamedly analog product on show that raised an eyebrow or two, perhaps, because it could be seen as representing something of an heroic last stand for the universally popular compact cassette. The Arcam Delta 100 is the first new British cassette machine in more than 12 years. Very much an upmarket deck, it has all the specification expected by the discriminating tape deck user. Three heads, dual capstan transport, automatic tape selection, fine bias control, real-time tape counter, even remote control. But what marks the machine out as something special is the fact that it's equipped with a piece of chippery that claims to take the performance of analog cassette decks towards that of the digital formats to be launched later this year. It's called Dolby S. Most people should be familiar with the Dolby noise reduction systems that have been built into just about every cassette deck through the 70s and 80s. The original Dolby A system, developed in London in 1965 by American physicist Ray Dolby, has been refined twice before, into Dolby B in 1970 and Dolby C 1980, each new step forward offering increasing degrees of hisslessness from what is an inescapably hissy medium. The latest Dolby Labs development, Dolby S, is a domestic offshoot of a noise-reducing piece of wizardry used in professional recording applications called Dolby SR. It works in much the same way as all other Dolby systems, the most commonly used option being Dolby B, which is built into almost 300 million cassette decks, by preventing the recording of hiss rather than filtering it from existing recordings. When sound is about to be recorded on the cassette, the quieter signals are quickly boosted, thus increasing the gap between the sounds that we want to hear and the noise, the background hiss, that we don't. Come replay time, with Dolby selected, the signal is reduced accordingly and thus hiss is reduced as well. While Dolby B is quite effective in masking a good deal of the annoying noise made by analog tape recording, practice proves that its performance is far from perfect. Dolby S copes with some of the shortcomings of Dolby B and C. The latter, Dolby C, depended upon the deck's heads being very carefully aligned and adjusted to tape type before the system worked effectively. Dolby S employs extremely sophisticated methods of eliminating the hiss, even when the signals being recorded vary considerably. The result is an improvement in noise reduction, which is especially impressive at higher frequencies, where most hissiness usually lurks, and which, for the first time, cuts noise at the bottom end too. It sounds, in theory, like a last desperate thrown lifeline for the compact cassette, which, after almost 30 years of world domination, is now facing the threat of extinction before the turn of the century. But for Dolby S to succeed, three things are necessary. First of all, there has to be some sort of foreseeable future for analog cassette. Secondly, pre-recorded cassette manufacturers need to offer tapes encoded with Dolby S, as well as, or preferably instead of, Dolby B, the noise reduction system currently used by most record companies. And finally, most hardware manufacturers need to offer cassette decks with Dolby S. To take each of these points in turn, though there can be no doubt that the analog cassette won't become obsolete as a format within the next few years, there are, after all, billions of the tapes and millions of tape machines in use all over the world, the digital age is surely upon us. Digital compact cassette seems to have a bright future, especially as the new machines are backwards compatible and will be able to play, though not record, old-style analog cassettes. Minidisc, a marvellous step forward for domestic recording technology, is exciting too, though there must be some reservations, partly about its fiddliness, mostly about the unlikelihood of sufficient software support to ensure the format's long-term survival, and here now, and likely to get considerably cheaper in the next couple of years, is CDR, recordable CD machines. Having been demonstrated at this year's Hi-Fi show by Kenwood, Meridian and Marantz, with Mission, Micro Mega and Pioneer also having machines just about ready to market. Still, though analog cassettes, like vinyl LPs before them, are inevitably doomed, there could yet be some life left in the well-loved tapes, and Dolby S could provide just the boost the format needs to ensure at least its short-term survival. As for software, it's just about impossible to imagine the record companies offering pre-recorded Dolby S cassettes. They're currently gearing up to put out DCC tapes alongside cassettes, and they're unlikely to change from Dolby B to Dolby S, when A, there are only a handful of S decks on sale anyway, and B, despite Dolby's claims that tapes with Dolby S encoding playback perfectly well on Dolby B equipped decks, the compression at work brings in a hint of the woolly sock effect, familiar to those who've never liked Dolby noise reduction in the first place. Finally, hardware. Though Dolby S has been available now for just over a year, before Arcam's announcement, only two manufacturers have had Dolby S decks on offer. Harman Kardon, who scooped everyone in having a Dolby S machine, the TD4600, on the market for last Christmas, and Pioneer, who put out the three-head CT93 a couple of months ago. It's interesting to note that any would-be manufacturer of a Dolby S deck must conform to a testing set of technical standards dictated by Dolby Labs. These standards concern error margins for the setting of the tape heads, overload margins, distortion, speed accuracy, wow and flutter, bias and sensitivity adjustments, and so on. All this is to ensure excellent standards of mechanical and electrical performance. But it means that their very nature, Dolby S-Dex are high-performance machines and will thus cost upwards of £500. In other words, you won't ever find Dolby S being offered on mini systems or on budget decks aimed at the mass market. Nevertheless, those manufacturers who are currently offering Dolby S machines remain quietly proud of what they're doing. Harman Kardon, whose two decks still retain the original three-chip Dolby S circuits, which were subsequently replaced earlier this year by a single chipset, haven't sold many machines so far, but spokesman Keith Haddock thinks that the problem's been lack of public awareness and understanding of Dolby S. "People have been confused about Dolby S," says Haddock. "They haven't been aware of whether it's worth spending money on it or not. Because they've already got a deck with Dolby on it, they think that Dolby S is just a reworking of an old system, which it really isn't. I think Dolby S will stand the test of time against digital compact cassette. Although it's older technology, the compact cassette is something that everyone's happy with. They've used it, they're familiar with it, so in a sense it's more attractive than digital tape, even if it's less exciting. There's plenty of years left in the compact cassette yet." Mike Martindale, development manager of Arcam, is also enthusiastic, particularly about the performance of Dolby S encoded recordings. "What Dolby S is doing is helping an established medium, cassettes being the largest selling product, to survive. The great thing about Dolby S is that it gives you noise reduction, but it doesn't lose the edges of the music, as happened with B and C. Instead, you retain all the interest, the dynamics, the life of the music. It really does manage to preserve all that." And Pioneer's John Banford's a Dolby S enthusiast too. "You can understand people being wary, because the great unanswerable question is whether or not cassettes are still going to be around in a few years' time. But that's no real reason for manufacturers not to use the technology that's available now. Dolby S helps make tapes sound fantastic. Quite simply, it's the best thing that's ever happened to cassette decks. But yes, it's possible that it might just have come along too late." All about Dolby S and Last Ditch Stand for Analog Cassettes by John Baldy in Q Magazine.
And one of the claims that they make in the advertisements for the professional equivalent Dolby SR is that some recording artists prefer to use Dolby SR than digital recording for studio use because they think it sounds better. So what Dolby S sounds like is another matter, however. On to a letter from V. Doige in Gunners Lake in Cornwall. "I'm writing to compliment you on the programme, which I found to be very interesting. I listen on an FRG770D receiver and an indoor aerial. The frequency of 3910 has a very strong signal into Cornwall and with good audio. I shall endeavour to listen again whenever possible to your programme. All the best for 1992. Well, thanks, Mr. Doige. Now, our latest in a long line of letters to the Radio Communications Agency in London, the DTI. "Dear Mr. Mitchell, further to your letter of September 1991, I'm enclosing for your interest a copy of a letter sent today to the Minister with responsibility for broadcasting. The letter outlines how the quasi-broadcast service of Radiofax could provide audibility at low power levels and be licensed within the radio regulations to which this country is a signatory. As you mentioned, very little HF usage is at present directed primarily at the country of origin. However, as we see cutbacks amongst international broadcasters and poor listening figures in the developed countries, something fresh is needed to revive interest in these parts of the spectrum." And our letter to Peter Lloyd at the Broadcasting Department of the Home Office. "Dear Mr. Lloyd, I'm writing to express continuing interest in shortwave licensing for Radiofax. We have been requesting the subject be looked at since 1986. We have contributed to the consultative process prior to legislation with a submission in 1989 in response to the government's green paper on broadcasting. Still, the issue of high-frequency services remains unaddressed. Without the advantage of local transmitters, Radiofax has a simplified schedule on frequencies which are either within a broadcast band or have some provision in the radio regulations for fixed services. We are not operating with anything approaching the power levels used in the broadcasting bands, and use of the increasingly moribund fixed bands is appropriate where a service is likely to be received for distribution around, for example, a residential building. The large number of blind listeners to Radiofax gives one instance of such use. Indeed, it could be noted that rather less convincing explanations exist for some of the out-of-band operations by the BBC World Service. In addition to letters Radiofax has received wishing the prospect well from Lord Thompson, chairman of the IBA, the Radio Authority, and members of Parliament, the station now has filed over 3,000 letters of support from listeners, collected during a few months of operation. Radiofax is described in the 1992 Radio Listener's Guide as the best thing to happen to radio for the last 20 years, while other comments in print have included the adjectives worthwhile, imaginative, and refreshing. Transmitters in this country would enable us to provide a more interesting and flexible programming, including up-to-date news. Is there a possibility yet of authorising transmission in this country of this valued quasi-broadcast shortwave service to our community of interest group? So we wait for the next stock answer to that latest letter asking for a licence in Britain.
Ground control to pilot. Ready? Ready? R for ruminant, ready for last minute, cockpit, check.
Yes, okay.
Largactyl, 5 milligrams.
Largactyl, 5 milligrams, check.
Valium, 10 milligrams.
Valium, 10, check.
Haloperidol, 5 milligrams.
Which ones, sir?
The little white ones. W for white.
The white ones, okay, check.
Phenobarbitone, 5 milligrams.
Check.
Dissipel. 5 milligrams.
Check.
Glass of water.
Check.
Our Father, which art in heaven, mea culpa, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa.
Cause of action, then it won't be to take. I'm trying to.
In The Observer, Irish state-owned broadcaster RTE and the Luxembourg-based media combine CLT are poised to launch a joint bid for the UK's second national radio franchise, writes Emily Bell. The CLT-RTE consortium is expected to face opposition from London's Capital Radio and Richard Branson's Virgin organisation. Veteran radio personality David Jacobs is also rumoured to be interested. CLT and RTE already collaborate on Atlantic 252, a commercial pop station which broadcasts to the UK from Ireland. A CLT spokesman stated that the two companies are at an advanced stage of negotiations. CLT has experience of the UK commercial radio market with its ownership of Radio Luxembourg, which broadcast from the continent on 208 until moving to satellite last month. The radio authority hopes there will be no repeat of the fiasco surrounding the auction for the very first independent national radio contract. Showtime Radio, led by Sir Peter Parker, won the franchise with a bid of £1.75 million a year, but could not raise the required start-up capital of £20.5 million, and the licence passed to Classic FM. The franchise winner will hold the licence for 8 years and will be allowed to broadcast as soon as a station can be established. Well, out of those two, the Atlantic 252 owners and Capital Radio and Virgin, I know which I support. Atlantic 252 provide a good service, and it's a shame to see Radio Luxembourg go, so hopefully we could see a replacement for them in this country.
In the Media Guardian, Peter Fiddick looks at research into radio listening figures. You don't get radio research figures very often. Wiring up all the telesets in a sample of households, as BARB do, for instant computerised monitoring, is problematic enough. But how does anyone keep tabs on the nation's ghetto blasters? Answer, they don't. The best that radio audience research can do is to ask people to fill in diaries, detailing what they listened to this week, put them in the post, and hang about until the results are processed once a quarter. We now have the results of October to December 1991, or rather, we now have several results. The Association of Independent Radio Companies, AIRC, the joint organisation of the commercial stations, published its fourth quarter findings. A week earlier, the BBC put out its version. The result is a clear demonstration that in the 3 months to December 1991, the BBC took a 62% share of the radio audience, and independent radio 35%. Or maybe that the BBC took 57% and ILR 38%. There are some pretty strange discrepancies. According to the BBC, it won on average 62% of the audience per week. The AIRC puts the figure at 56.8%. Independent radio gets 35% according to the BBC, 37.9% according to the AIRC. The grossest gap is at the bottom line of the reach columns, where, according to the BBC version, 77% of the population, amounting to 41 million people, listened to some radio station during the average week, while the AIRC's version puts the percentage reach higher, 91%, but then translates it into a lower number of people, 39.3 million. Confusing. The BBC's survey is based on the entire UK population aged 4 or over, a figure which it takes as being about 54 million people. The AIRC's survey, conducted by JICRA, the Joint Industry Committee for Radio Audience Research, interests itself only in adults aged 15 plus, and then only those within reach of an independent radio station, so that its total population is reduced to 43.1 million. This goes a long way towards explaining that bottom line difference in the total reach figures. It begins to explain why the BBC's figures give most of the BBC channels a better result. They include areas where there is less competition. It could even offer a clue as to why the BBC's two ratings weaklings, Radio 3 and 5, actually fare better in the AIRC chart than in the BBC's. The former might be expected to be relatively more popular amongst this survey's older audience. Overall, however, there is little basis for comparison between the two. A new single joint system, to be known as RAJAR, is expected to function from next September, none too soon as the corporation faces crunch decisions on how to use its airwaves and national commercial radio approaches. But it is also why there is absolutely no excuse, meanwhile, for both sides not to make their methodological differences explicit on everything they publish, let alone for the AIRC to highlight on its press release this rather portentous quote from its director, Brian West, who said, "These latest JICRAR figures confirm continuation of an absolutely rock-solid trend dating back to April 1990 of a steady shift of listening away from the BBC radio services to independent radio." Yet, figures issued by the BBC, based on their own research, were accompanied by a claim that their overall share has increased and is 5 percentage points higher than JICRA measures it. That entertaining piece by Peter Fiddick in The Guardian.
You're listening to Sparks on Radio Facts 3910 6205 and 12255. A letter from Mark Jones, who lives in Peterborough. "I'm 24 years old, and I'm a DJ by trade, so as you can see, I have a good interest in the music business. I've been into DXing for some time, but only got some better equipment about a year ago. The radio I listen to is a SciShow 3000W, which is the same as the Sangyan ATS 803A, which sells for twice the price, but is exactly the same. I have a 144-foot long wire aerial attached to it, which, because I live in a flat, I can hang out the window. I was very surprised, as I have it in a ball on the floor, and the reception is no different than before. I do live on the first floor, however. I've been listening to Radio Facts every week since last April, from the All Music Show with Chrissy, as to your excellent Sparks show. I'm writing this and listening to your show about Radio Caroline. Reception is good on 6205 and on 3910, the signal at night seems to vary. I don't know if you reduce power, but sometimes the signal you just can't hear, then other nights it's good. Well, our power is constant, but we fade because we rely on bouncing off the ionosphere to get to you. Lumps of ionized air aren't terribly reliable, so sometimes reception is good, sometimes it's bad. The other effect you can hear occasionally is the sudden loud rush of distortion. This is where parts of the signal get passed through stronger than others, altering the level of the sidebands to the carrier. This is called selective fading, and you need a synchronous tuner to get rid of it, unfortunately. Back to Mark Jones's letter. One of the biggest things that makes me laugh is a local station near Cambridge called CNFM. They reckon they broadcast in digital stereo. They don't even play compact discs all the time. I shall keep listening to you. Well, thanks for the letter, Mark Jones. Some short items. A UK mainline telecommunications network provider and a UK network operator are actively pursuing hundreds of millions of dollars provided by the World Bank to beef up the Polish telephone system from 87 lines per 1,000 people to something approaching the UK level of 400. UK electronics companies are in the lead in pursuing Polish contracts, according to the country's Ministry for Privatisation, followed by the Americans and the French. UK companies are apparently looking for acquisitions which will give them manufacturing capacity in Poland, where wage levels are 10% of those in the UK. Sony has strongly denied rumours that its digital recordable disc system, Minidisc, will only be able to record once on a disc when the hardware is launched at the end of the year. A spokesman insisted the format would be recordable and erasable over and over again, and that recordable prototypes would be available soon for demonstrations. Sony hopes Minidisc will eventually replace the compact cassette. Of course, there's a rival system from Philips, the digital compact cassette. And British Telecom is planning to offer a national service tracking nuisance telephone calls later this year. It intends to set up a number of counselling bureaus to help the victims and has provided the police with technology to catch nuisance callers. The company has been running a trial malicious caller bureau in Canterbury and is now evaluating the results. We will be introducing that sort of system on a national basis, according to a spokesman for the company. The tracing technology will become available to the police as digital exchanges are introduced. So far, about 50% of the exchanges around the country can perform the trace called malicious caller ID. BT will only carry out the trace after a request from the police. The victim of the call has to make a complaint to the police, which they use to start a criminal inquiry. The only legal way to provide MCID is in response to an official police request, according to the spokesman. BT has already carried out 2,000 traces using the technology. In Bradford, the police have run a publicity campaign to encourage victims to approach them. Those items from Electronics Weekly. And a recent letter from John Goodlife in Cheltenham outlines perhaps the other side of the technology that the new exchanges can be put to. Manual telephone exchanges using old relays are now virtually all superseded by the System X digital exchanges, plus fibre optic links. The advantage of System X is that in the case of civil disturbance, they can disconnect all of us, whilst all of them, i.e. government departments, can all still talk to each other at the flick of a switch. Also, remote, undetectable tapping becomes possible. All good fun. Well, John includes an old article about phone tapping, which I've read. It's very interesting. And it does show that there are two sides to the new features you can get from digital telephone exchanges. There are quite a few things that I don't think we know goes on involving them. Thanks for that large bundle of stuff from John. You're listening to Sparks on Radio Fax, 6205 12255 and 3910. I'm
Profile of the scientist Stephen Hawking in The Observer. Caged mind that roams the cosmos. Locked within the wasted limbs and wearily lolling head of Stephen Hawking lies a fundamental contradiction. His physical form may be declining, yet his imagination seems to strengthen daily, launching him on journeys that soar further and further beyond the limits of our comprehension. Two cross currents, one marking cerebral progress, the other corporeal degeneration, have coalesced in the withered frame of the world's most famous living scientist. Recently, the 50th birthday of this remarkable researcher was celebrated with a fanfare worthy of a Hollywood star. Two biographies have recently been published, and the film of his staggering bestseller, A Brief History of Time, has opened in Los Angeles. No praise has been too lavish for the man hailed as the new Einstein. He's not quite that, but let's not spoil the party. Behind him lie honours, authorship of two of the greatest scientific papers published in the history of physics, a broken marriage, and inexorable physical degeneration. Time, his subject, has been a harsh master. Born on the 8th of January 1942, Stephen William Hawking grew up with a brother and two sisters in the stuffy middle-class sanctity of St. Albans. It was a safe life, tempered by parental iconoclasm. The family car was a London taxi, for example, and the family holiday retreat a gypsy caravan. His father, Frank, was a medical researcher whose continual field trips to Africa characterised his principal contribution to parenthood, his absence. By contrast, his mother, Isabel, was an enduring influence. A former Communist Party member, she became a stalwart of the Labour Party and CND, causes to which Hawking remains strongly sympathetic. His schooling at the local public school was, by contrast, traditional and unhappy. Puny, gauche, and the inheritor of a slight lisp from his father, he became the stereotype of the schoolboy swot and a target for much classroom persecution. He responded by eschewing games and pop music for a world of jazz, classical music, debating, and the construction of primitive computers made out of cannibalized radio and television parts. His friends were generally admiring. As one recalls, Stephen had incredible instinctive insight. While I would be worrying away at a complicated solution to a problem, he just knew the answer. He didn't have to think about it. This early description highlights several Hawking traits, in particular his extraordinary capacity to visualize scientific solutions without calculation or experiment, a power that was to prove a godsend as physical incapacity slowly robbed him of the power to wield even a pencil. It also reveals the intellectual self-confidence, some might say arrogance, that is another Hawking hallmark, and possibly his saviour in later years. Yet his teachers thought him only a slightly above average pupil. Nevertheless, he won a scholarship to University College Oxford and began to blossom, adopting a raffish, worldly, offhand demeanour. At Oxford, you were supposed to be brilliant without effort, or accept your limitations and get a fourth-class degree, Hawking says. Few questioned which category he fell into. One fellow student recalls his effortless completion of complex papers, which were then screwed up and pitched into waste paper baskets on their return from his admiring tutors. His demeanour, once lordly, was becoming imperious. To no one's surprise, Hawking gained a first in physics in 1962. Deserting Oxford, he headed for Cambridge and postgraduate research in cosmology, a subject of the grandest scope and just right for the resolute, unquenchable intellect of Stephen Hawking. His first term was grim, however. His acquired lisp was beginning to dissolve into a slur, and his movements became clumsy. A friend, journalist Michael Church, recalls a family party at that time. Stephen could not pour the wine accurately into our glasses. The stuff kept going over the carpet. These were early signs that something was wrong. Tests revealed he had motor neurone disease, a rare wasting condition of the nervous system that slowly paralyzes the body and which usually leads to death within 2 years. That was 30 years ago. Legend has it, Hawking then plunged himself into a brooding bout of heavy drinking and listening to Wagner, though he now denies the former charge. The realization I had an incurable disease that was likely to kill me in a few years was a shock, he admits. How could something like this happen to me? Why should I be cut off like this? There was consolation, however, for at this time Hawking fell in love with a young language student called Jane Wilde. She was also smitten, and they married in 1965, subsequently producing three children, Lucy, Robert, and Timothy. I wanted to find some purpose to my existence, and I suppose I found it in the idea of looking after Stephen, she said recently. She was not blind to his faults, however. He was very, very determined, very ambitious, much the same as now. A perfect snapshot of Hawking in full determined contemptuous flight is provided by George Ellis, a friend at Cambridge. The pair travelled to the Royal Society in London to hear the redoubtable Fred Hoyle, then at the peak of his career, outline his latest theory about the nature of gravity. The lecture was warmly received until Hawking, clutching his stick, stood up. The room was slowly silenced. Stephen told Hoyle, in simple scientific terms, that his theory just did not work, says Professor Ellis. Hoyle asked him how he knew. Stephen answered, because I worked it out. Everyone burst out laughing. This was just a second-year research student, after all, but Stephen turned out to be right. It was my first realization that Stephen had a truly outstanding mind, not just a fine one. After completing his thesis, Hawking began the serious pursuit of the mysteries of the cosmos. He concentrated not on equations, which he found increasingly hard to write down, but on the geometry of the universe, which he could picture in his mind, producing a series of papers of increasing elegance. Two are remembered for their particular brilliance. The first, published in Nature in 1974, outlined a baffling contradiction, that black holes are not black. In essence, he showed that black holes, collapsed stars which are too massive to let even light escape from them, can still emit some types of radiation. On its own, this discovery was of only marginal scientific significance. However, its underlying mechanisms have profound implications for understanding the first few seconds of cosmic history after the Big Bang birth of the universe. Even more importantly, Hawking carried out this work by successfully combining two previously irreconcilable branches of physics, relativity and quantum mechanics. The second paper was even more esoteric, proposing a model of the universe that had no boundaries in space and in which time could be measured in imaginary numbers. Baffling to all but a few, the paper was nevertheless enormously influential. By this time, Hawking, now Lucasian professor of mathematics at Cambridge, was confined to a wheelchair, and in 1985 he lost the power of speech after a bronchial infection. Today, his movements are restricted to two fingers of his left hand, which he uses to operate his only link with the outside world, a computer-driven voice synthesizer. By rights, he should have died long ago, and Hawking's stoical, tenacious fight for survival has deservedly brought global honours. The most remarkable sign of recognition, however, has been the public's response to A Brief History of Time, his layman's guide to cosmology. Published in 1988, the book has sold more than 1 million copies in hardback. It is alleged that most remain unread, the book being incomprehensible and only popular for its trendy inscrutability. In fact, Brief History is lucid and well-written, though it is not unique. Scientists of equal stature, Richard Feynman and Steven Weinberg, for example, have also expounded on the cosmos with equal clarity, but considerably less success. They, of course, lacked the romance of a genius trapped in a wheelchair, but still apparently able to turn mental cartwheels round the cosmos. It is an image that verges on the mystic, which explains the initial appeal of brief history and possibly the subsequent recoil against its uncompromising rationality. But perhaps the greatest surprise in Hawking's life was the collapse of his marriage. After 25 years of apparent tranquility, Hawking left Jane in 1990 to live with his nurse, Elaine Mason, provoking several bitter outbursts from his wife, who announced she would no longer have to spend her time simply telling him he's not God. Hawking will do what he wants to do at any cost to anybody else, she added. And that, quite clearly, is the price that has had to be paid to keep alive one of the most remarkable minds that has ever lived. That profile of Stephen Hawking in The Observer.